January the 24th, 1961, and an extraordinarily fierce forest fire is bearing down on Dwellingup. Some surrounding townships have been evacuated, and all firefighters recalled to protect Dwellingup town. Residents are sheltering in cars on the football ground or in the hotel. Back in the Dwellingup forestry office, we pick up Frank Campbell's story.
I reckon it was about 7 p.m. I remember Bruce Beggs taking a small group of men down into the forestry yard to try and save some of the vehicles, and then I didn't see him again. The others had left the office. There was nothing they could do. The ember storm had arrived, and the burning brands, they were just falling thickly all over the place, and houses and buildings started to catch alight, including my own house that was next door to the office. This is when I ripped the front of my shirt off and wet it in a pack spray, and I wrapped it around my face so that I could breathe and went to try and save my house. I still thought my wife and kids were inside. There were other men in a tanker there desperately trying to save the house. It was hopeless. I ran back to the office, and it was by then well alight. My car was parked at the front, and I ran to it, accompanied by Sonny Cave, the forest ranger from Mundaring. Now, the front seat of my car was alight, but we put that out and climbed in. It wouldn't start. It must have been the petrol in the carburetor. It vaporised or something, anyway. But at last it fired, and we just tore off. I was heading at Alan Hatch's house, where I hoped my wife and kids might be. As we drove headlong down the main street, a power line dropped across the bonnet of the car and then swept over the roof. I instinctively ducked and sat up and then found I was heading for a shop front. I swerved back onto the road and kept going. At this moment, I spotted the hatch car on the oval. There, being minded by Nan Hatch like an old mother hen with her chicks, I found the wife and kids.
Meanwhile, what was going on at Bankshiredale, the mill town just northeast of Dwellingup? Peg Blanning and her husband lived at Bankshiredale, but by the second day of the fires, virtually all the men, including Peg's husband, had been called up as firefighters, and only the women folk were left in town. Peg recalls.
On the Tuesday, about 2 p.m, we got word that everyone at Bankshiredale should be evacuated. The fire was bearing down on us from the north. There were mainly only women and children left by this time, as almost all the men were out fighting the fires. I loaded up our Holden utility with our personal possessions and picked up my mother and father from their house. Dad was placed in the back of the ute on a mattress. Other women who had a vehicle and could drive did the same, packing children into the cars or the utes. We left Bankshiredale in a convoy with Harold Day at the head, driving the mill bulldozer. Fallen and burnt trees and logs blocked the road and had to be cleared so we could get through. The plan was to drive to North Dandalup, but there was a lot of smoke about, and we decided to stop the night at the old forestry settlement at Huntley. The settlement had been closed a few years before the fire, but the site had been completely burnt out a few days before. The old brick chimneys were all that were left where the houses once stood. Oh, no, there were dozens of dead, burned kangaroos hanging from the wire netting around some of the buildings where they'd been trapped, trying to escape the flames. But because Huntley had already been burnt, we reckoned it was a safe place to stop for the night. At first light next morning, Wednesday, we ferried everyone down to the North Dandalup Hall. Several of us had to do 3 or 4 trips between Huntley and North Dandalup, and at the hall there was a good supply of food. We were well looked after. Volunteers from the local community, they'd all pitched in to help, preparing sandwiches for fire crews and making cups of tea. A lot of these people would have been farmers' wives. And just after lunchtime on Wednesday, Roma Kemp and I decided to go back to Bankshiredale with food and fresh milk for the men who were fighting the fires nearby. There was pitch black smoke everywhere, but we got through to Bankshiredale and distributed food to the firefighters. Mr. Perrin from the mill office told us to return to North Dandalup because the fire was still dangerous. One of the mill workers who'd been fighting the fires, Norm Page, he'd collapsed through exhaustion. We put him in the back of the ute and headed for Huntley.
Banksherdale miraculously survived. Forest officer John Slater had only recently emigrated to Western Australia from Scotland, but he soon showed his worth. After a day and a night in the field, helping to organise firefighting bulldozers, he found himself back in town just when the fire hit.
I had been instructed to stay in the Forest Department yard and assist with its defence. There were three of us. Bill Hayes, the dwelling up storeman, was one, but I can't remember who the third was. We went round the yard, closing up doors and sheds, and we got the last of the stock of 4-gallon drums and pack sprays out of the store and filled them all with water. These were then positioned round the buildings in the yard in the hope that we could use them effectively when the time came. Well, the futility of all that became apparent as soon as the fire front hit. With the smoke pouring in over the town, it was an early dusk. The smoke cloud then began to light up with bursts of orange and yellow and got progressively brighter. And the wind was rising, and the noise of the wind and approaching fire front, well, it was considerable. And burning embers began landing in the yard, which we extinguished, and for some minutes we thought we might win. But the light shower of burning material became a firestorm as the front came through the bush at the far end of the yard. Burning bark and offcuts were being lifted from the sawmill waste heap and hurled through the air. The mill building succumbed, and then the heavy-duty gantries and the Livingstone huts at the back of the yard were consumed one by one. Roofing iron from these office buildings began scything towards us, making our cross-yard trips hazardous. The long shed in the middle of the yard got alight at the windward end, and the fire tore through the building. This culminated in a massive explosion, which we found out afterwards was probably caused by a store of industrial alcohol used by Alan Hatch in his research work. Well, we realised about then that the fire front had passed us by, leaving a residual of blazing hedges, houses and other buildings. We decided it was time to get out. Now, the strange thing was that in all of this, I didn't feel really frightened. I'm very impressed by it all, and of course very aware of what was happening all around me. But I was still able to function. Now, there were a number of vehicles parked in the forestry yard, most with keys in the ignition. We decided we would each take one and make a run for it. Well, I took a near-new hardtop CJ5 Jeep, and one of the others took another forestry vehicle, and the third choice was a private vehicle. I drove out the gate into Dell Park Road, stopped to pick up someone who emerged from a drain on the far side of the road and headed for the brightly lit hotel.
There were numerous similar stories in Dwelling Up that night, including one from Gloria Wilmot. Gloria Warren, as she was then, was 17 years old, living with her parents, her grandparents and her six siblings in a forestry house on the Banksherdale Road. Her father was Jimmy Skinny Warren, the famous forestry overseer. Gloria tells how, as the fire approached, her mother, Mrs. Warren, rose to the challenge.
Mum took charge. Some of us were put to work hosing down the walls of the house, others to soaking hessian bags and blankets in the wash house and the bath. All the windows and doors were shut tight and fastened. My young brothers, Alex and David, were then told to push Dad's ute out of the garage and onto a cleared area out the back of the house. Mum then assembled us on the front veranda. As we stood there, a huge fireball soared over our roof and made a direct hit on the Grider's house on the other side of the railway line. The house erupted into flames and instantly disintegrated. Mum sent David round to the wash house to collect the wet bags, but in a moment he returned empty-handed. The wash house was on fire. Fortunately, we still had the wet blankets that had been soaking in the bath. We grabbed these and set off, Mum was herding us like a flock of chooks. There were 9 of us. Her elderly parents, me, Elizabeth, Alex, David, Mary, the toddler Heather, and Danny, the family dog. Mum's idea was to head for the football oval or the hotel. But we had left our run too late. The fire caught us before we even reached the railway line. There was a hollow in the ground in front of Jim Carroll's house, some sort of drain, and Mum bundled us into that. She huddled us together and covered us with the blankets, but these dried out as soon as the heat struck them. So she got me up, and she and I ran across to Carroll's to re-wet them from the rainwater tank, carry them back, and get in under them until they dried out again. We made 3 or 4 trips before the tap stopped running. As I ran back and forth, I could see that the houses, hedges, and parked cars down Bankshadale Road and the forestry office were all burning.
One of the things that has struck me most vividly in many stories from the fire was the courage and resourcefulness of women like Gloria's mother. Like women folk everywhere, in times of crisis, they rose to the occasion. There were many acts of heroism and selflessness that night, but only one story makes me smile. Quoting again from Frank Campbell's story.
So when the fire near Mount Wells broke on Tuesday afternoon, my assistant, Alan Hatch, well, he telephoned Albert Kalmans, the Mount Wells lookout, and told him to evacuate immediately. Well, Albert, being Albert, refused to leave his lookout tower. The senior officer present was Bruce Begg, so he got on the line and made it totally clear to Albert that he had no option in the matter. This was as well. The whole mountain was incinerated and the lookout tower was totally destroyed. So when Albert left, he took the logbook with him, and later we read in it his final entry. Abandoning my post in the face of the enemy on the instructions of DFO Beggs.
Aged only 18, trainee forester Gerard Van Didden was another to display courage and fortitude. Just before the fire struck, he had been assigned the job of looking after a row of houses in the eastern part of town. Gerard recalls.
By now the wind was raging and intense showers of sparks were flowing through the air. Spot fires were starting on the walls and in the gutters. At first, I found them relatively easy to put out, using a bucket and drawing water from the rainwater tanks next to the washhouse, and spraying with a knapsack. As I worked, moving from house to house and back, it suddenly struck me that I was completely on my own. When the main front hit, the heat was very intense. Inside the Sclater's washhouse, I found foil-lined tea chest, and I crouched down and pulled this open. This shielded me from the radiant heat. How long I crouched there, I don't know. But after a while, things seemed to calm down a bit, and I decided to give it another go and get to work again. I had to breach rainwater tanks with my axe to get the water. I can't remember feeling scared. Maybe the stress and the lack of sleep over the previous days made me numb to the real danger. Or maybe, still being only 18, I thought I was indestructible. What I do remember is losing all sense of time. Things were going on, but had no reality. I also became overcome by loneliness. Eventually, as dawn came, I found my way to the Hatch house, and I was overcome with relief to find a number of families gathered there. Mrs. Hatch gave me a cup of tea. I then went back on patrol and kept at it until nearly 10 a.m. the next morning when I was stood down.
Many people sheltered at the pub or in cars on the football oval. One of these was Muriel Galloway.
I was in Mrs. Hatch's car. She was behind the wheel. And on the front seat were Pam Campbell, her baby, my 7-year-old son, and me. On the back seat were my 2 daughters, 2 Hatch daughters, 1 Campbell daughter, and the Hatch dog. Oh, it was an uncomfortable night.
It was a terrifying scene in the pub, with the thunder of the fire outside and the terror of families with kids inside. Elizabeth Saville made it to the pub after a nightmare run across town in which she had to dodge sheets of roofing iron flying through the air. In the pub, she took charge of her grandchildren.
During the night, great fireballs hit the town. The whole town was burning. We could see the CWA hall through the window of the hotel and watched it burn to the ground. Many times during the night, the hotel caught fire, but the fires were put out. There were men on the roof with knapsack sprays and buckets. We kept all the doors and windows closed to prevent sparks and embers blowing in, but there was one funny yet sad incident. Someone opened the door to go outside and a kangaroo came bounding in, seeking refuge from the fire. I spent the night sitting by the children, who were now sleeping. When day dawned, the fire had subsided and we were all given a cup of tea. Later that morning, some people from Brown's Dairy down at Pinjarra came in with fresh milk and ice. The ice was used to soothe sore eyes. We all sat on the veranda, our legs dangling over the side. Time didn't matter anymore.
Edith Stewart and her husband Dick also spent the night in a car on the football oval as the town burned down around them. She recalls,
"We had two young people, Graham and Beryl O'Malley, sheltering with us in our car. They had a tiny baby. It was terribly hot and everyone was anxious. Beryl could not stop the baby crying. In the end, I wet a napkin from our canvas water bag and sponged him and cooled him off. And then I made him a bottle with water from the water bag and some condensed milk that Dick had with him from his firefighting rations. That baby grew to be a strong 6-foot man, proving that the lack of boiled water and hygiene did him no harm."